the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Ah, the children of the night. What sweet music they make. Probably one of the scary aspects of Bela Lugosi, channeling, of course, our own inner fears. And you might sort of think, well, what are we talking about, that kind of horror state of events back in the days of the halcyon wet British summer that we're currently enduring? Well, there is a reason, because actually August the 2nd is the date of birth for, of course, Wes Craven, a creator of A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Hills Have Eyes, and, of course, the whole range of other aspects within this whole side of things. And to share with us some of the reasons why the whole notion of horror not just being for the autumn, in fact, being probably a year-round thing, but certainly for August as well, we're delighted to welcome assistant director of creative development and show direction at the Universal Orlando Resort, of course, creator of, amongst other things, of all of those great monster movies that we've appreciated over the years. It's Laura Sauls. How are you, Laura?
I'm great, Alex. How are you?
Well, great
Thank
to connect
you for
with you.
Having
Absolutely. Always a genuine delight. And also fascinated to see that you started off your career not just singing, but singing and dancing as the Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah. Actually, 27 years ago, I started as a singing and dancing Bride of Frankenstein in a show that was called The Beetlejuice Graveyard Review. I was singing with other of Universal's classic monsters like Frankenstein and the Wolfman. And it was a spectacular start to my long career at Universal. Universal is the creator of the classic monster, right? Universal Pictures was they started the monster genre, if you will. And we're so proud of that. And we keep that going because Universal brings back the Universal Monsters every year to Halloween Horror Nights. Because we love the monsters so much. It's ingrained in our soul, if you will. It's definitely ingrained in my soul because it's been a part of my career for a very long time. And this year at Halloween Horror Nights, we have another Universal Monster House where we're featuring the Phantom of the Opera, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, the Invisible Man, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I mean, what can I say? Elsa Lanchester would be proud to see that her legacy is still being kept alive and well. And now that you've moved on from the Bride of Frankenstein, the musical version, to, of course, assistant director of creative development and show direction at this Orlando resort. But no mention for my own favourite monster, of course, which comes at the back of Kurt Siodmak's classic line, "Even a man who is pure of heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright." Where's the wolfman?
We love the Wolfman. Last year we had a haunted house that was based on Wolfman, Mummy, and Dracula, and they were all going after this amulet, fighting for it. It was one of our best haunted houses we had at Halloween Horror Nights, and we're so proud to just keep the Universal Monsters in the mainstream and to really keep their legacy going, if you will.
Although it's interesting that recent research suggests that people's biggest fears are those of arachnophobia, of course, spiders. And, of course, I thought they'd gone for good, but no, you just can't keep a good zombie down. Zombies and spiders. Presumably that means, well, there's got to be a place for the mummy surely arguably was an early zombie, was he? Were they not?
Yes, I believe he's one of the original, if you want to call him the OG zombie, if you could. I've also heard in research that evil clowns make it into that kind of top of people's fears. And we love a good evil clown. We have one of our own evil clowns that we created. His name was Jack the Clown. And he's been around for quite a while. And people love him in Orlando. He's become an icon, if you will, of Halloween Horror Nights.
Were they not just confused that he was representing a famous hamburger outlet with a golden arch, though? Is that things long gone? You can't actually sort of be associated with Ronald in any way, shape or form now. He's just an evil clown.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, he's quite spooky himself.
Yeah, very much so. A fifth of us, of course, say that evil circus is what gives us the shivers. Now, it's interesting in terms of that evil circus, which I suppose ties in with the evil clown as well, because vampire circus, obviously, that was a part of the Hammer opening to the whole thing. But that's something I hadn't really seen as being a circus, although the carnival is certainly embedded and deeply rooted in terms of the American psyche.
Yeah, and you know what's I find it interesting that evil circuses really get under people's skin, which is interesting, and we really hone in on that when we create haunted houses. And this year at Halloween Horror Nights, we actually do have an evil circus in Dr. Oddfellow's Twisted Origins Haunted House. And we really exploit those fears of, you know, we have evil clowns and we have twisted aerialists and contorted bodies that are shoved in a box, all those things that of course an evil circus would have.
Well, Laurie, you're already beginning to scare me at that particular stage. But let's assure our listener that in terms of actually scares, the scares are there. But just as in good comedy, and I've done a lot of academic papers in terms of how comedy and horror can be seen as two sides of the same coin, basically. You both have that jump reaction and also the cathartic approach. Within Universal, presumably our audiences at the Orlando Resort can be assured that ultimately they will emerge safely from the experience.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do at Halloween is stand at the end of a haunted house, because when you stand at the exit, you see those people, that last scare, they're jumping and running out of the house, but they're also then falling into laughter. And I think there's an endorphin that happens when you get that good jump scare, but then everyone ultimately falls into laughter. So I think that's why we like to be scared.
Well, I hadn't been aware that if you're a Buddhist or indeed Taoist, August is indeed Ghost Month. So, although clearly Halloween, Hallow Scream, all of those activities for the autumnal months are probably sort of one of the aspects that's there. And clearly, Ghost Month, when the gates of hell are flung open, that opens up a whole new era from the whole side of things there. Do you have a Van Helsing character, Laura, that emerges, or indeed, a good guy, Jonathan Harker, effectively will sort of try and defeat these fiendish demons and killer clowns and such like that are around?
Well, we really don't have a hero. We like to just keep it spooky all the time. And to go back to August, yes, August starts spooky month for so many reasons. But we actually start training our characters during August. So it aligns perfectly with the fact that August is the beginning of the Halloween season.
Always felt sorry for Frankenstein when he first met Elsa Lanchester's Bride of Frankenstein, because there was Boris Karloff trying his very best to echoing out there. He's sort of, oh. And of course, she just screams. I mean, it's what can you say? It's just a dreadful scenario. Clearly, an early case of dating gone wrong, basically.
That's true. That's true. That's the ultimate. That was the ultimate, dating and then completely destroying themselves, right? That was honestly when I got the job to be the Bride of Frankenstein, they told me to watch the Bride of Frankenstein movie, which I hadn't watched before, unfortunately, but I watched the whole thing. And sadly, I was like, she was only in like 5 seconds of the film and then was destroyed. So, because of that, a few years back, we had a haunted house that we decided to tell a whole new story with the Bride of Frankenstein, and that the fact that she didn't die in the castle crumble, and she found that the Brides of Dracula's blood would reanimate her Frankenstein. And so we had a whole haunted house at Halloween Horror Nights based on the Bride of Frankenstein lives.
Well, of course, and indeed, you could argue that actually the actress who portrayed Mary Shelley at the start of the movie was also the bride as well. So from that point of view, at least she wasn't shortchanged from that perspective. But maybe a whole new concept of conscious decoupling, as somebody would say. But still, that's a different line. How can people actually book tickets for, or indeed look to attend this fabulous event that you've got up at Universal Orlando Resort Laura, how should they go about it?
Well, we would love to ask everyone to go to HalloweenHorrorNights.com, and then you'll find out all the information you need to get to Universal Orlando and come to the world's premiere event.
Well, Laura, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. We've got two final questions, which we need to put to you contractually for Siren Radio, of course. Firstly, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
This was lovely. And I love your backdrop. The rainbow is inspiring.
Well, I figured that in essence, we could go for a Hallow Scream approach. We could have actually gone for all manner of avatars and links within that. But I thought, keep the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow going, and then you'll get there in the end. That's the important thing. So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you come back sometime and keep us appraised of all the great stuff you're doing as assistant director of creative development and show direction at the Universal Orlando Resort?
Alex, this was beautiful to be here, and I will definitely be back.
We will simply actually utter the words that were written to me via the medium of Facebook from Victoria Simmons. It's pouring and very windy. 16 degrees in France. Feels like October. Internet takes 1 minute per page to load. Love to everyone. I don't know, back in the day when the internet took 1 minute per page to load, obviously wouldn't dream of doing what we're doing now and actually doing the midweek drive predominantly via Zoom. But what the hey, you know, that's it. You know, what's the weather like in North Carolina, Jessica?
We are usually getting up to like 36 every day, at least 34. So it is just a very hot time over here. I think what makes the heat like particularly bad in the Carolinas is like the humidity. We're a very humid place, so it's just like a wet heat, and you just want to shower if you go outside, so not the best. But it's actually, we're in a bit of a cold spell right now for a few days, so hopefully that English weather is like kind of influencing us.
Yeah, well, you know, nice and sort of wet, etc. I thought I'd pop up in the background there for the benefit of the mind's eye of the listener. I think that is that your home street basically, or your hometown?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so I used to take a little right and then you go up and that's me, and
wow. There we are. So there we are, Tosin. We've got an invitation to actually join Jessica Burtis in North Carolina, and we just map out exactly where she's based. Brilliant.
We'll be right there.
We have, of course, Tosin Siemi back with us for the midweek drive. And again, we're doing this primarily via Zoom. So how's life now you've spent over a year in Lincoln, Tosin?
Life in Lincoln. I like life in Lincoln. I think Lincoln is a cool place. I think for me to enter the UK as a resident for the first time and move to Lincoln, I think it was one of the best choices I made, because the big city is kind of the big city and it can be crazy. But Lincoln is like a combination of like a big city, but also like it's kind of close-knitted. So it's kind of cool to be in Lincoln, to be around places that are connected to each other. I like the way the school is built around the old town. Like you can go to a building and you see a lot of things about Lincoln. And like, it's just walking one. It's just cool. So the first year in Lincoln, I'm grateful to be in Lincoln, and I'm grateful to like enjoy the experience I've enjoyed so far.
Unfortunately, Tosin, you haven't had the full experience that Jessica had of having a pandemic emerge midway through your actual piece itself. I know it's unfortunate.
I think I'm good.
You can skip that. You don't need it.
Yeah,
because I know, Jessica, the way when you took the class that I ran with respect to Communication Society, and we're working our way through that, we're talking about the way in which the pandemic was growing, how it was developing, etc. I mean, you decided clearly that it needed to be developed and experienced to the full, really, from that perspective.
I did. We needed to understand what digital communication was like. It was all a grand plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've just actually had more communication from another one of our North American correspondents that he's actually on his way, which is always very exciting when we hear that Phil Linus is actually on his way. So hopefully he won't be too long before he's joining us, which neatly ties into something else, which I wanted to actually raise, which we heard at the start of this little segment of the Midweek Drive, which is a whole little feature with a lady who started off her particular career by being the Bride of Frankenstein, no less a singing and dancing Bride of Frankenstein. She's from the Universal Orlando Resort, and she's Laura Sauls. That's Laura Sauls, as in S-A-U-L-S, not Laura Sauls, as in obviously the Scouse Liverpudlian version of saying, you've got a Laura Laura laughs there, or souls. As Laura was actually saying, August, apparently, guys, is far more terrifying if you're into horror movies than any other month of the year. It's August that we should be fearful of, and not October, November. Was that something that you were aware of, Jessica, that those Halloween people got it all wrong?
Well, I mean, August is, at least for the US, the back to school month. So maybe it is most horrifying. I know it was when I was in K through 12.
Yeah, I mean, we also found, again, we heard of this, that in terms of fears that we've actually got for this, the reason August is so scary, it's because actually, if you are of a Taoism belief or a Buddhist belief, August is the ghost month. It's when the gates of hell are flung open and all of those ghosts can actually escape. The 2nd of August was actually mentioned in Bram Stoker's Dracula as the day when more crew members were to disappear from the ship, leaving the first mate to jump overboard rather than face, obviously, that thing. I mean, fill in as August as a terrifying month of the year. Is that a case of, is this simply Universal Hollywood gone crazy in Orlando? Or is that something you'd echo, that actually August is pretty stressful?
You know what? Historically, I think August is stressful. I mean, we call it the dog days of summer here. And it is when the heat gets oppressive. Of course, in California, it's fire season. And we turned the page to August. And after our wettest year on record, which meant blissfully our easiest, our most gentle fire season to date, boy, you turn the calendar to August 1st and our largest fire erupts. So I think there's more to it than just superstition. It is interesting, the door to Hades, literally here I am talking about heat, right? And it culminates in Los Angeles in Southern California in October, when we get these dry Santa Ana winds, which are hot, burning winds. So you think, okay, the temperature outside is 70. That's beautiful. And you round a corner and you feel a wind, and it suddenly feels like you're in 120 degree weather. That's how hot the winds blow in October. And of course, as we know, that's heading straight long into Dia de los Muertos and Halloween, when the veil is at its thinnest between the worlds. It's almost like August begins that 3-month process to the netherworld, as you're describing. And I think it's always been stressful in America. You're ingrained in the stress of it as you're growing up, because after spending much of July bored, because you're so grateful that school is out for the summer, but then after a few weeks, you do get bored and you kind of miss seeing people. But then in August, we're back at the end of the month. What have I done with my summer? I better make every bad choice now while I still have time.
Tosin, in Nigeria, do you echo this, or is it a case of, look, in Nigeria, everything is planned out, a season for everything and everything in its own place?
Them two sides of the coin, where everything's kind of planned out, but at the same time, anything can happen at any time. So, like you said, like the August time, like towards the end of August, like, oh my god, I've been on holiday for like 2 months now. What have I done with my time? And then you're scared about going back to school and like not enjoying that time. But at the same time, that sometimes that like, during there's some things that happen that we had to resume like September, October, instead of this thing. So you had a lot more time to enjoy your holiday. So it depends on what's happening in the country and how things are happening. Well, most times it's planned, to be honest. It's a miracle that happens. Maybe August will not be the month you resume school and you have a week more, 2 more weeks of holiday, basically.
You know what I love about it's Tosin? Towson?
Yeah.
It's Tosin. What I love about listening to you is that as you're describing stress, your voice is so relaxing to us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's like I could hear you talk about stress all day, and I would just feel my stress just evaporate.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Really appreciate it.
It's another whole routine. Jessica, as you're probably closest of all three of us to Universal's Orlando Resort, will you be taking up Laura Salz's offer of the Universal Studio Tour, which this year is very much focused on the Bride of Frankenstein singing?
That'd be so interesting. I think that I mean, Frankenstein is one of the classics of horror. I don't know that I'd want to go to Universal in August because that might be a special kind of torture. But I think that outside of August, it'd be a perfect activity, a very nice autumn activity. No, Phil says no.
No, because under ordinary circumstances, you might, but since you want to show support for the creative artists that make the movies and TV shows that you
True.
love,
That is true.
you want to boycott
That is true.
Universal and all theme parks owned by the media giants.
True.
Right? That's what you meant to say.
It is. No, I was just thinking seasonally, but I should be thinking critically.
How dare you, Alex, set up such a
Oh.
trap? Such a trap.
I
Listen,
know.
We don't want
I think.
Jessica to be given the nickname a scab. She's a scabber. She's crossing the pickets.
Don't worry, don't worry. I'm not going to Universal anytime soon. Don't worry, no plans, no plans.
And there was Laura Sauls in all innocence doing the interview at the start of this piece to actually say, look, honestly, just turn up and come and see the joys of Universal horror. Okay, speaking of horror, one of the themes we actually had.
Universal horror. The joys of universal horror is such a loaded phrase.
Well,
I feel like that is what happens every time people see news reports around the world about our former president Donald Trump. I feel like we're all collectively enjoying universal horror at that point.
who knows, he may still be a returnee to the White House. I mean, it could still
Oh, I
happen for
know. I know. Is it wouldn't that be? I'm kind of it's so weird that like talk about the Gates of Hades opening. Look, nothing makes sense. We find out, what was it? Very recently, right? In the Mariana Trench, in the depths of the ocean, we've discovered this new species that is not fully biological. It's part biological, part plastic. That this species of underwater life actually has incorporated plastic into its being. So it's a hybrid of biology and plastic. And that is not nearly as weird as the concept that Trump could become president again. I mean, I love it. Open the doors to Hades. It's August. Let's go.
And that's why I was so pleased that NASA has picked up, as we said earlier, a heartbeat signal from the Voyager 2 space probe. It thought it had actually lost contact with it completely, but it's still operating. Little Voyager 2, or as it probably will now be known, VGER, VGER, is still actually out
VOY,
there.
VOY. AGER. VOY. How long does it take William Shatner to spell out and realize VOYAGER spells Voyager? It's fantastic. The movie would have been 20 minutes shorter if he could spell better.
Speaking of movies, Jessica's completed recently a critique of the joys of Oscars or Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel. Phil, any thoughts? Because so far, Jessica's for once not been the positive. I mean, Victoria Simmons gave it a 9. Kathy Mansour way down on a 3. Jessica came in at a 7.
I don't know this musical Carousel. I'll be honest with you. As a former mini minstrel who used to tread the boards in musicals when he was a young man, I shamefully have to admit I've never seen a production of Carousel, let alone the movie. I only know that it is incredibly influential, especially I think lyrically and. Again, I don't know, but its influence was dramatically felt, and it would be referenced a lot by all the purveyors of the Great American Songbook for the second, or let's say the last quarter of the 20th century. And so is that on display at all, Jessica, in the movie version? That can you tell why it might be artistically influential?
Artistically, yes. I was telling Alex that my favorite part was the music, and the visuals because it was so beautiful, and the idea of somebody
Oh, you see, a
in heaven
curse of the
pulling
North
stars
Carolina
and
link.
seeing them. But I think Tosin even heard my explanation. My problem is not the artistry of it. My problem is the representation of domestic violence and the redemption arc for a domestic abuser. That is my problem. But artistically, gorgeous. Plot-wise, I have issues.
I need to see again. This would have triggered me. I don't, Yeah, I'm glad to know now that I missed it for a reason. We can't be anywhere other than we are. And so the challenge is always to find out why are we where we are, when we are. But by the same token, there's probably reasons we're not where someone else, i.e. Alex, might want us to be. And I just learned why I was not ever watching Carousel or participating in the conversation.
Don't worry, Phil. There's always V for Vendetta. Meanwhile, Tosin, one of the things we actually had on our sequence for this...
Sorry, go ahead.
Was indeed the notion of shock tactics and public relations. And I did actually share with Phil parts, just a little part of your dissertation. Would you like to, for the benefit of the listener and for Phil, share with us why not only are you combining the historical aspects of Benetton with a more updated version, share with us what you're looking into and how that's panning out in terms of how actually maybe anything goes when it comes to getting talked about?
Yeah, so basically, controversial ads and controversial marketing has been a big thing in advertising for a while. And a big player in that space was Benetton with director Oliver Toscani. He was an Italian photographer. His dad was a photographer too. So he always wanted to do shock advertising where he sparks a conversation about social issues. So he did he collaborated with United Color of Benetton to make all these shocking advertisements or controversial advertisements. There's one about like a black man and a white man shackled together. There's one about a white kid being breastfed by a black woman. There's one about like two children, black and white. One is an angel, one is a devil. You can kind of see where this thing is. There's one about AIDS. There's one about cancer too. There's one about various issues. There's one about death row, this thing too. So why my own perspective of it was that although they were doing all this controversial and there were a lot of backlash from it, the crisis communication was always, they put a foot down that this is what they're trying to succeed with this, this is what they're trying to create a conversation on these social issues and everything about it. And then the reason how I wanted to relate it to Balenciaga is that Balenciaga has been controversial in the ads too. But their own, their latest ad, one where there was a child with a teddy bear in bondage, and there's also a bag with a constitution of like abortion listing on the, a paper of the constitution on the bag, on under the bag, and it caused controversial conversations on Twitter and everything. And the reason I wanted to relate to them is because the way Benetton handled it and the way Balenciaga were total opposites and were in total different times. Benetton did it in a time where social media wasn't really at its peak, where you could just release a press statement and that's the end of the conversation. Where right now with Balenciaga, you can't just release a press statement. You have to show that you've learned from your wrong. You have to show that, like, okay, we're at fault, but we know how to move forward. We know how to stop this thing. We know how to, like, contribute to society and say, okay, we did this wrong. We're going to contribute to this charity. We're going to create a conversation about this and everything. And even with that, Balenciaga even did it wrong because they didn't even try to claim responsibility for the ads. They tried to put on their prop company, Not6, and Not6 obviously sued them for it because they gave them the distance and Balenciaga approved it, especially their creative director, they approved anything. So it's a really weird situation where I'm trying to look at how Balenciaga carried out a crisis communication and why it's so bad and why they couldn't use Benetton as an example of, like, okay, just stand behind and say, take responsibility for what you did, but also at the same time, know that there are ways to get back to it. And I'm just trying to understand how people look at Balenciaga now after that, after 6 months after that matter, basically. And how
since the manure hit the fan, Tosin, since the manure hit the fan. I mean, if only they'd actually done some domestic violence with a 1956 movie, it would have been mild. But no, they had to go down this path. Yeah. Phil, any thoughts or questions? Yeah,
yeah. Oh, so many. But when Alex told me about this dissertation, yeah, I had not thought of Benetton in decades. And I remember the launch of the United Colors of Benetton, and it was refreshing. It was beautiful young people of all colors, all backgrounds. And it was like, well, what's wrong with that? And that itself was controversial at the time, just having advertising that was for everyone. So it's kind of shocking for me to realize Benetton is still a thing, actually. I didn't even know that. But what I am curious about asking you is these ad campaigns that are so shocking, there's a degree to which most of clothing manufacturing businesses are shocking. The yeah. way that these around the world, the exploitation of resources of humanity, the exploitation that the clothing industry is built upon is in most cases quite shocking. And so I wonder, like, it's almost like Benetton is just admitting what the whole industry is like.
Yeah.
Is the controversy, though, over something like this going to distract from how monstrous the whole industry's behavior is?
I think it does for a while, but the thing about, like, right now, the thing about the clothing industry is that everybody gets a piece of cancel culture now because all of them are in the wrong for certain things. Entirely. Some companies will be in the news because of their sweatshops, like Balenciaga is in the news because of their ads. Some people are in the news because of their stealing designs from little designers and trying to change them.
And environmental exploitation, yeah. the lack of sustainability in so many
cases. Yeah, all of them. So I think it took away from, obviously, all those other issues at that point. But I think we're back to the point of, like, these are all the things they need to work on. And cancel culture and even the fashion enthusiasts and people around there are really working on it. Like I said, fast fashion, fast fashion for, like, ASOS, Shein, all these other brands, they've really been trying to put down on them and trying to be like, we can't keep doing fast fashion. We're polluting the earth. We're doing this, we're doing that. But obviously, during the time of Balenciaga, they focused on Balenciaga. But I think it's a circle where, okay, there's an issue, there's a big issue with the company, they work on that, and then go back to, like, the general issue of, okay, we need to work on all these things together and try and settle it, basically. But it's just a calling out session of calling out every company one by one. I'm making sure they all adhere to the rules and work out their issues, basically.
Jessica, I'm sure, Alex, you've... Oh, sorry. One follow-up. I was curious about, and you probably have said this before on the show, so Alex, cut me off if that's true, but what brought you to this as your thesis? Why?
I was just, like, honestly, I was just looking at for topics in public relations and communication, and I saw crisis communication, and I remember that while I was in a course with Whitaker, it was talking about Balenciaga and how they were handling the whole debacle of the controversial ads and everything, and how they didn't do well. So I was like, oh, that's cool. That would be we could touch on how they try to solve the problem of the crisis communication they're having and how they approached it and if it worked for them. So from there, Alex told me about United Color of Benetton and it became much more interesting than what it was immediately. I was like, this is going to be a crazy ride. And since then, I've been looking at it and I'm like, this is really a cool topic and I really want to explore it more.
Tosin, I always like to give my students a crazy ride in a legal way, of course. Jessica, from your own perspective, any thoughts on fashion?
Oh, I mean, I guess from just a consumer perspective, I don't really have, like, the expertise that Tosin does, but, like, just viewing it as somebody who, like, consumes it, it is crazy. The like, just seeing it on social media with, like, the hauls where people will have, like, 100 Snaplock bags of, like, Shein clothes, it's crazy. And, like, the fact that fast fashion is one of the largest, like, contributors to pollution at the moment is just wild. I had no idea, but it's, like, one of the largest contributors, and the way that it's just constantly marketed now through, like, social media is just, I don't know, you can't get away from it.
Yeah.
And you can't resist it
everywhere.
I mean, that's the other thing. I'm all, you know, I will do whatever it takes to defend Mother Earth, unless it's a really funny T-shirt. And then, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I've done that a couple. Like, wait a minute, I've got to have that Wuhan Virology Institute T-shirt. I have.
Well, I think it's cool if it's like one clothes or two clothes, but it gets worrying when it's like 15 clothes, like you're buying it 1 month and then next month you're buying 50 more clothes and you're not going to wear everything. And because it's so cheap, you're like, I just need to get it. I need to get it. And the quality is not even crazy again. So you end up dumping it after 1 year. So if it's one or two, sure, obviously we'll allow it. But if it's 15, come on, man. That's a lot.
You know, It's one of the things about vintage fashion that's so fascinating. You know, somebody who's a wonderful collector and renovator of cars once told me when the Prius was becoming the most popular car, and we didn't know the environmental impact of what just mining that battery was going to be. He said this to me 25 years ago. He said the most environmentally friendly car you will ever have is the one you're driving right now. Keep that operating for as long as you can, because the greatest impact is on manufacturing something new. So keep your car running. And if you can take care of it and it can last you your lifetime, you have minimized your impact. And I think about that with clothing. It's so much fun to shop for older clothing, even like the silly, funny t-shirts like I was talking about. Yeah. I love getting t-shirts, vintage t-shirts that were made 50 years ago that exist. Why not wear those? And they're fun and they express my personality.
Yeah, since I learned about like fast fashion and what it does for the industry, like I've been moving towards like thrift shopping and like just going to random every month I do it as a plan that every charity store I see, I just enter and see if I can find any vintage piece there and buy it and just add it to my collection. Because that way I'm maintaining the this thing process and I'm not buying a lot of fast fashion clothes. So it's I think it's a practice that a lot of people should learn to do. Just like, it doesn't have to be every time, but like just learn to look for vintage pieces and go there and get some one or two things. It really helps the society and planet and everything. Pollution.
And don't get things you're not going to use.
Yes. I think what that's the thing. Green, like a lot of people love, I can have this. Why can't I just get it? I might wear it one time. We are not really sure. It's a really stressful thing. Just because you can get it, you want to get it. But if you think about like, will I reuse it? It will help us a lot more, to be honest.
It's nice to see that the environmentally sustainable Midweek Drive is continuing its own way, because clearly, just think of the carbon footprint we would have had to exert if we'd flown Tosin in from Nigeria, Phil from Los Angeles, Jessica from North Carolina. I mean, I couldn't have justified that at all. Whereas as it is, we've maintained our integrity and hopefully saved the planet in its own way as well. As we found out from the York Maze recently, it wasn't just Phil, Dean Haglund and myself who were helping to save the world with the Myathon. It was obviously the York Maze having the theme of the Myathon. But as Tom Piercy also said, that was a time when maybe he defended the Mayan gods in the same way as this year. The theme is Tutankhamun. The results, continuous rain every single day since it's opened.
This historic rewriting of how we saved the world at the end of the Mayan calendar is a bit of revisionism. I mean, I know you were optimistic. You took the point of view that history is replete with apocalypse, the lifting of the veil, as it were. But Dean and I literally were thinking we were ringing in the end of the world with you. We were celebrating.
And that's the difference between the pessimistic American and the optimistic Brits, you see. It just shows the balance that's actually there. It's very important.
Yeah. And by the way, the whole thing about the world's coming to an end, I can't tell that it hasn't.
Yeah, well, you know, we just have to work our way through that. I mean, clearly, that's another time for another session. Tosin, have you enjoyed your time on the Midweek Drive, your first official Midweek Drive Zoomer?
Of course. I always enjoy it, yeah.
Excellent. And Phil, has it been good for you?
Wait, am I leaving? Are we done? Is there not another half hour?
Well, we've kind of packaged most of the goodnesses together. Although, having said that, there could be part four.
Look, you sent me information about two guests that I prepared for. I actually have questions for guests that were on earlier. I mean, I don't know. So if you send me homework, what would also be good is send me a time. Because I thought I was a half hour early. I usually show up at 6:30 your time. And I just did that math in my head. When I went into show business, I was told there would never be any math. So you're welcome. But yes, so I guess I'm just complaining. I'm wasting precious, valuable final moments.
It's perfectly okay to feel that agony, but do not worry. I'm sure that Shaco.
If I hadn't done research for one of your guests, would I be able to do this with this book? I don't think so.
We will have to connect that next week.
But I'm always delightful to get to see Jessica. She's my favorite. Alex, you're my second favorite. And I have been dying to get to talk to Tosin, who I find very
good.
Very
enjoyable.
So, it
was good talking to you too.
And the Nigerian film industry continues to grow. So, Phil, I take it a reasonably interesting Zoomer for yourself.
It was unreasonably interesting, thanks to our pal Tosin.
And Jessica, one of the things about August is you don't have to worry about selecting a contributor of the show, most valuable contributor, because they're put together in such a wonderful way. So you can relax on that basis. You can ease back a little bit on that.
Why and why make Tosin feel bad when you say it was me? You know, that's, I think it's better that we don't do that.
Exactly. This is the whole summation. But earlier in this particular segment, thank you to our Universal Orlando head assistant director of creative development. That was, of course, Laura Sauls, who kicked off this whole fear-based thing. And thanks to Tosin and to Phil Leonis and, of course, to Jessica. To you, dear listener, keep on keeping on. Stay dry. And obviously, let's hope that when next we speak, we'll seeing them continuing to progress in the World Cup. Or will it be Nigeria? Or will it be the USA? Or are they just effectively giving up the ghost? Thank you.
when I think I'm winning. When I've broken every door, the ghosts of my life grow wilder than before. Just when I thought I could not be stopped, when my chance came to begin, the ghosts of my life grow wilder.
The pantry. Be it ever so humble, there's no place for storing your food stores like the pantry. Or maybe there is. Maybe things are actually changing, and maybe we need to actually look at the way in which in the 21st century the pantry might be resuming its popularity. Well, who better to actually speak to about this particular survey from the Wix Great Kitchen Report, of course, than BBC TV social history expert, of course, the awesome Professor Deborah Sugg-Ryan. How are you, Professor?
I'm good, thank you, on a soggy day.
Well, yes, but what better place to actually take refuge in a soggy day than your pantry, where you can actually consider all sorts of things if you're lucky enough to have one. I'm fortunate enough so far as, yes, I still do have a pantry, but that's probably because I was living in a house which it's over 120 or so years old. But is the pantry making a comeback, shall we say, in terms of a place to store food and more?
Yeah, what's interesting in the Wix Great Kitchen Report is that the pantry emerged as the number one desirable item, with over 21% of the 2,000 people who responded saying they wanted one.
And is that because of people looking back nostalgically? Is it because they've actually had a notion of where things are going? Or is it just a case of the kitchen has outgrown its usefulness? There's too much stuff happening in the kitchen. We need somewhere else to store food.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that the pantry reflects a number of different trends. So the first one is a change in the ways in which we are cooking, that partly driven by the cost of living crisis, there's a desire to buy things in bulk. So we might get the bog off bargain in the supermarket on our rice and our pasta. So we need somewhere to store those dry goods, which is traditionally what the pantry was always used for. And of course, it doesn't necessarily need to be the walk-in unit that we think about from older houses. It can simply be a tall larder cupboard in your fitted kitchen, or it could be a corner unit. So you can use that to store your dry goods, but you can also use it as an appliance garage, because one of the things as well that's happening in the home is we're all accumulating more and more of these countertop appliances. We might have had things like coffee makers and food processors and NutriBullets and bread makers, but these have been joined by the new must-have items, the multifunctional one-put hot cooker that combines pressure cooker and slow cooker and other functions, and of course the air fryer.
Yes, the I would say almost notorious air fryer, because I've had mixed reports in terms of don't get one, get one, do get one, etc. I mean, is it all a case of it tends to follow a fashion, and as trends for the clutter-free kitchen continue to evolve, ultimately we're saying, well, we want something where basically our personalised home robot can actually occupy its space happily and do all the cooking for us?
Yeah, there are some trends towards smart kitchens, and certainly that idea of guided cooking in these increasingly smart appliances that tell you how to do things. That is another trend that is coming as well. But I think one of the things is that we want our kitchens to work harder for us. So we want them to be a place in which we cook, but we also want them as a space to relax, to socialize, to entertain. Loads of us are working from home some of the week. This hybrid working is here to stay. So we need a kitchen as a space that feels relaxing but is also functional as well. And it's really interesting if we think about the spaces of our home, because whereas in the past you might have had a parlour or a sitting room for best of that space you took visitors, you're more likely now to want to take them into the kitchen. So we need the space to be able to work in terms of to be able to eat in it as well as cook in it and relax in it as well. And so that's one of the reasons we're seeing some of these new trends that came up in the report.
Farmhouse, vintage, rustic, and industrial, all adjectives which were used as buzzwords to best describe people's preferred kitchen style. I mean, surely most kitchens are kind of a combination of all of those, really. I mean, some are industrial, some are farmhouse, or is that a case of no? Ultimately, I've got the ideal kitchen in mind, and it's what I saw in that TV program.
Well, I think we've had a trend for quite kind of minimalist industrial style kitchens. And interestingly, that came out at 8%, whereas farmhouse came out as the top buzzword in the survey at 17%. And I think that does reflect this idea of this sort of relaxing, casual, homely dining living kitchen. So I do think, you know, that is a bit of a change, and that partly comes from us spending more time in our homes in the pandemic, and comes in an increasingly informality in the way that we live. So in an older house, we might want to reconfigure the space to reflect this. And we're beginning to see this trend come through in new houses as well, with less space occupied for a living room. So you might get the idea of the kind of TV snug, and the big entertaining living space is an open plan kitchen. So I think we are changing the way in which we live. And this has also come through in the report in terms of colour, which was one of the quite surprising findings for me. We've had over a decade of grey and white, and, you know, grey everywhere.
And silver nothing... and chrome, presumably, as well.
Yeah, really, and there's nothing wrong with that. I have a lot of grey in my own house. but interestingly, in the report, colour kitchens were increasing in demand, with blues and forest greens amongst the most popular options. And I think it's no coincidence that these are colours associated with nature. When we were all cooped up at home in the pandemic, you know, lots of us longed to get outside. And of course, we've had that bringing the outside in with use of things like bifold doors in kitchen living rooms. So, but that also reflects the maximalist trend in interior design that's being driven by millennials. So we are beginning to see some real changes in what the kitchen of the future is going to look like.
And I suppose when you consider what the kitchen of the 1920s looked like compared with the kitchen of the 1980s, these things tend to move fairly drastically, really, and world events can impact them.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting is in Britain, we were fairly late adopters of the fitted kitchen. They didn't really take off until the 1960s. So although they were available in the 20s, most homes didn't have one. And the thing that became very popular in the 20s, which is the period where we started to become a nation of homeowners, and you also had the big social housing building by local authorities as well, is this freestanding kitchen cabinet that combined the kind of larder and pantry functions with storage. And lots of, I'm sure your listeners will remember them, the famous manufacturer is Easy Work, but there were others. So you open the doors, it had all these storage containers, including a funnel, a hopper for flour, and a pull-out work surface. And that idea is now starting to be incorporated into the kitchen again, this idea of that tall unit, which is quite useful because it can hold loads, and then it frees up other areas in your kitchen to be used for other purposes.
wix.co.uk/Wix Great Kitchen Report, presumably the best place to go into a deeper dive in terms of the report. We really just covered the surface of today.
Yeah, you can read the kitchen report there on the Wix website, and you can also find out about Wix lifestyle kitchens and Wix bespoke kitchens, which can give you this larder option.
Deborah Sugrian, Professor of Design History and, of course, BBC TV social history expert. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on, Deborah.
Thank you.